is UFM. With Green Firm, a nourishing addition to any sandwich, salad, stir fry or snack. Natural protein, your way.
A massive thank you to the fantastic Jenny Green. It's Wednesday, the 5th of May.
Coming up on Game On tonight, with minors and under-21s cleared to return to train, we check in with Damien Lawler.
Catch from Bonner Maher from Darren Gleeson's puck out. He's going for it. He hits it. It's in the back of the net.
Can Chelsea join Man City in the Champions League final? We ask Richie Sadler.
Cross. Breaking ball for Vinicius to chase. Vinicius took it well and finishes.
We check in with Irish marathon runner Aoife Cook.
We're also checking in and tattling our feelings with the great Robin Coblin.
Now, if you want to get in touch, please do so. You can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
Game On on 2FM.
Now, as I just mentioned in the intro, the under-20s and minors are back in action, so the GAA season is beginning to take a little bit of shape. And to talk us through it all, we're joined on the line by RTÉ's Damien Lawler. Damien, it feels like an admin week for GAA reporters and correspondents, because there's a lot of sorting out been done.
A lot of sorting out. It's moving week in many ways, Marie, with the Allianz Hurling League starting on Saturday. Good to get all the clarity. It's been a while coming, especially for the minor and under 20 managers, many of whom have been at their wit's end trying to get some sort of a frame on what way the season is going to pan out. Just to give some context, 2020, there's outstanding minor hurling and football games to be played, Marie. If you're a county like Offaly, you're on the road back. You're in two Leinster minor finals and you're at a standstill. Brian Hanley, the Galway minor manager, his team hasn't even played a game yet in 2020. So this has all been going on in the background. If you're a Cork, then you're in the under 20 hurling finals in 2020 and you're waiting for the other finalists to join you to play off. So Pat Ryan is the Cork manager in 2020 and 2021 for both panels, and it's very, very difficult for the likes of him. Offaly have dual players, so the whole thing was a bit of a mess, to be honest with you, on paper. But GAA couldn't do a whole lot until they got clarity from the government. That clarity finally arrived yesterday, in that we got a call from the Department of Sport Special Advisor maybe around 4 o'clock yesterday, letting us know that inter-county challenge matches could take place from May the 10th. Now, there's been some speculation that could be even brought forward, but also telling us that match day panels could be extended to non-playing members as well, which we got clarity on today. And then I just asked about under-17 and under-20, and the insinuation there was that the game should be good to go on that front in terms of minor and 20 from June the 7th onwards. Then this morning, the 2020 minor managers got a correspondence from Croke Park saying that they'd be back in training next Monday and they'd be able to play games from June the 7th. We were wondering, would it be the same for under 20 cohort? And around lunchtime then, the counties got clarification that was the case. So within a very short space of time, a lot was known, Marie. It took an awful long time to reach this vantage point, but when it did, the information flowed pretty quickly.
So it's safe to say it's all happening, Damien.
All happening, yeah. And so many kids looking for... I mean, leaving cert's a huge issue here, especially with under-20s. And I think you've got weird ones, Marie, where minor teams in the six counties could train, but Monaghan, my own godson is on the Monaghan minor panel, and they couldn't train because they're in the 26 counties. So all sorts of stuff like that. It's no harm to get it down on paper. I'd be so happy when the games start, Marie. I won't lie to you.
Damien, leaving cert aside, it is an important group to get back in out playing, isn't it? It's always the driver of a club. It's always a really important part of your development, playing at this age grade.
Yeah, Donica, it is, to be honest with you. And I think at under 20, I would have been involved with the Tip under 20s a couple of years ago, and even from that squad, three or four guys stepped up to the Munster final and winning panel. So I mean, that's a good graduation in itself, but really it's a developmental age group as well, and the GAA see it as that. And I just think that, look, you know yourself, if you're in the Munster Academy and you're trying to make the breakthrough, gains and exposure are what it's all about. And like the year we played under 20, we only got one championship match, but I think we played about 19 challenge matches, and that's where the lads built up their fitness and built up their conditioning and got into that. I guess now we have to wait and see when those games will actually slot in. I'm led to believe the 2020 minor games will take place around July, but I suppose will there be a break then between that and the 2021 minor and the 2021 under 20 that has to be seen yet. So the CCC will make a decision on that next week, and we'll probably have the schedule early next week, and that'll be the end of that.
So, Damien, before we move on to the ladies' football and camogie, just a little bit on the hurling this weekend. We had Dee O'Keefe and Sean Finn on last night talking about the new playing rules, and they said they hadn't really done a huge amount on them. I'm not sure now if they were being honest or not, or if there was a bit of shadow boxing going on about them. But just what's the feeling on the ground about how they're going, how it's all going to play out, really? Because it does feel like there's a lot, really, for referees to try and look after now when the games get going.
Yeah, definitely. Interesting they say that, guys, because the referees have had no competitive games or no challenge matches. Now we're hearing today that challenge matches can now take place at intercounty level from today onwards. That's correspondence coming in from Croke Park as we speak. But just to go back to your question, Marie, the word that we're also getting is that referees who are refereeing in-house training games have had to explain to players what's happening. So just to summarise it, denying a goal scoring opportunity, advantage rules, temporary substitutions, misconduct by team officials, interfering with kickouts, puckouts. There's additional new rules there for 2021, including aggressive infractions and stuff like that as well. So it's trying to break down cynical play. And I suppose you've got your 20-metre arc, whereby if a player is denied a goal-scoring opportunity, there are ramifications from there. But the referee has to consider, where is that foul occurring? Any defenders are between the attacking player and the goals. Could another defender make a tackle before reaching the goals? And how many players are in the area in front of goals? So the referees an awful lot. That's the question I asked Nolan Smith today, the head of the National Referees Association. But he said that they're going through every step they possibly can. They had fitness tests last week, but they did video analysis. They're going through every rule step by step. And that as the weeks go on, there will be a general consensus. But it's up to the interpretation of the referee in any given match day, Marie. That's important to point out. So hopefully those interpretations won't be too different from game to game, that some sort of general consensus will be formed after a few weeks. But I do expect there will be a few incidents here and there. There's no point in saying otherwise. I think it's human nature, because as your guests on the show were saying, not a lot of people are giving a thought, and some players especially. So we'll see fairly soon who's been doing their homework and who hasn't.
Yeah, a lot being asked to the referees, Damien, and put that on top of the considerations of adding more subs. Is it 7 they're looking at using in the Allianz League?
7, Donica, and I suppose what they're trying to do there is balance the load on players, whereby statistics are showing that last year especially the return to play saw a big amount of injuries, a surge in injuries, especially soft tissue. But soft tissue injury over a short season, Donica, as you well know, can ruin your campaign. So what they're trying to do is they're trying to cut down on the load by letting as many players in as possible. It's going to go to management tomorrow that 7... 7 substitutions can be brought in. My information is at 5 intervals only. So with 5 intervals only and a water break in each half, that's 7 stoppages straight away. So they are wary of keeping some sort of a flow to the game whilst also working the load of players as lightly as they possibly can, I guess.
And moving on to the ladies' football, Damien, they announced today that their championship is going to run from July until September, and it will commence following the conclusion of the National League, and they start on the 23rd of May. So all very straightforward with the ladies' football.
Yeah, look, it is straightforward. And I mean, I think that the word got out last weekend that they were going for the split season, Marie, and that probably shone a light then on the Camogie Association structure, which was probably under a huge spotlight at the weekend, and we all know what happened there. They decided to go with National League Club Inter-County Championship structure, and 84% then of WGPA members rebelled against that. And I suppose the message came out of the weekend that if the structure said the same, those players would not be taking part. So then the fact that the LGFA announced the split season, you already identified in the clash between dual players, between LGFA at Intercounty and club players at Camogie level, which was another issue to throw into the pot. To be fair to the Camogie Association, they took heed of what was said, and at the end of the day, they're going back to their clubs and members this week to take a look at what's going on and see what their new mandate is going forward. It'll be very, very interesting, really, because I would feel some of those clubs and some of those members may have supported the original structure. So I think Camogie has a lot of work to do to get to a consensus. But I do believe a consensus will be found, and they know the GPA's feelings and the WGPA's feelings on this matter at the moment as well. But certainly, it's not straightforward. They're trying to look after all the club players too, and the intercounty players feel that not having a split season is not a good idea. So there's definitely conflict there.
Damien, there is an awful lot to it, but there is little strides as well with travel expenses now being afforded within the league campaign.
Yeah, Donica. So the LGFA announced their decision officially. It's supposed to be mooted in the last few days to pay players from travelling teams 30 cents a mile for their expenses during the National Leagues. And that's got to be welcomed as well. And I think the union between the GPA and the WGPA is a fantastic thing. It could actually be a template, or it could at least set the scene for the amalgamation that we all want to see happen, or that a lot of us want to see happen between the associations itself. Because even in terms of getting venues and getting pitches, I mean, you'd imagine it'd be streamlined a lot easier if it all went through the one umbrella. But there's a lot of work needs to be done before all the kind of the links can be joined together. But Donica, as you were saying, there proper order too with the 30 cent a mile for travel expenses, and there's a long way to go. But this is a good start as well, and it's a positive. After kind of some negatives for women's sport in the past week or two.
Damien, I think you're right. It does feel like they are starting to move in the one direction, and even just seeing a lot of hurlers and footballers coming out and supporting the Camogie players in this and just giving their views, their support has been, I think, quite heartening, because it's not something that you see very often, especially in other sports. We've seen in soccer and rugby that their male counterparts are so slow to come out and support them. So just fair play to the hurlers and footballers for getting behind them, because it's important for a change that they do that. Damien, we're going to leave it there. We've got through everything, I think, that we possibly could. Delighted to see the action coming back this weekend, and hopefully we'll just be talking about results and not real drama on Monday, but I doubt it.
Do you promise?
Thanks, okay, Damien. Guys. Talk soon.
Game on 2FM with Green Fern. Naturally good food packed with protein. Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. Now we are turning our attention to football, and news just in. The Manchester United-Liverpool game that had to be postponed over the weekend because of fans' protest has been rescheduled for Thursday the 13th of May at 8:15. Richie Sadlier joins us now on the line. Richie, just on the Manchester United-Liverpool game, the game was obviously postponed because of the protest. It garnered a huge amount of attention. They've been calling for a change. They've been pointing their fingers at the owners. They're not happy with a lot of what is going on in the club. Solskjaer came out today and said that supporters do need to be listened to, but he has called for any future protests to be civilised. Do you think we're going to get more protests on Thursday the 13th of May?
Well, I think what hasn't changed is the strength of feeling among the United supporters that showed up on Sunday, and among the several, like, countless others that weren't there. The opposition to the way in which the Glazers are running the club is as strong as ever. And I think either it shows the strength of feeling, or maybe the desperation among the supporters to get their voice heard, that they would go to the lengths that they did. I mean, if you think about it, like, to stage a protest with the specific aim of getting a game postponed, like, is a hell of a thing to set out to do. And then actually to achieve that, it's a stunning, like, stunning outcome to any protest. So it was wildly successful. It's got everyone talking about it. It's certainly given them a voice on an international, global stage. You know, everyone is talking about the reasons why they would protest and the way in which the Glazers run the club. But to answer your question, will there be more at that game? I don't know. I assume Solskjaer will repeat what he said today. Maybe the other players will, and maybe there'll be some kind of a coordinated effort for people in positions of influence to come out and urge the supporters to demonstrate their opposition in another way, to show their disapproval in another way. And I don't know whether that's going to be that effective, because they've been unhappy for a long, long time, and they've been voicing their opposition for a long, long time, and they've been ignored. The Glazer family, or representatives of the family, have never spoken directly to the club supporters. So I don't think we've seen the last of it on Sunday, but the strength of feeling is obviously huge, and it's the announcement the previous week of the club's willingness to go into the Super League and abandon the Champions League. I think that just really was the final straw for so many people. So yeah, we're going to see a lot of strong views being expressed in lots of different ways, I think, for quite a while from United fans. I don't know what's obviously the most straightforward thing to do here. You condemn the violence, certainly anything aimed at police, and you condemn the destruction of property. But what's trickier to do is to plot a pathway from here to a change of ownership for the club, because the Glazers are making a hell of a lot of money from being in the club owners. They're not putting anything in, and the value of the club is going up and up and up. So from a business point of view, it is very attractive. The obvious alternative to a protest is to boycott the club, but it's difficult to boycott games that you're not allowed to attend in the first place. So it's the story's going to run and run, I think.
It did feel like a bit of a moment, I have to say, at the weekend. Roy Keane said on the coverage that this is just the start of it, and you'd kind of have to think that it probably is. They got a huge amount of coverage, but did it really achieve anything when it comes to change? Not yet. And as you said, Richie, they are business people, and what matters to them most is how their business is doing. And when it's doing well, then it's hard to see why they'd bother doing anything different.
Exactly, and I suppose the other question then that you have to raise here is, if the Glazers do decide that they no longer want to run the club, obviously somebody else has to come in and do it in their place, and there's no guarantee that United supporters are going to be happy with the way in which any successors of the Glazers decide to run the club or finance the club or the decisions that they make. Because when you get into that level, you're obviously dealing with people who are driven by profits and driven, like, motivated by making money, which isn't a bad thing, but it sometimes is totally at odds with how supporters want to run the club. So it is it's a complex enough scenario, because the Glazers own the club. But supporters right across the Manchester community and right around the world believe that they have ownership of the club, and that the club wouldn't exist or couldn't exist without them, which of course is true. So it's a complex issue, but I don't know if the Glazers are going to be particularly upset or have complete changes of heart or massive changes in direction about how they run the club simply on the back of one game being postponed. Everything we know about them would suggest that it's probably made little or no impact on them.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with you, Richie. And then if we just move on then to Manchester City and PSG in action last night. And again, like, you're just looking at the ownership there of those two clubs, and it's hard not to dwell on the negative parts of it, and the fact that money motivates football, or football revolves around money in such a big way now.
Yes, but when you look at the ownership of both of those clubs in particular, I mean, I think a lot of people listening to this conversation, and I understand that they'd be sitting there like, will you shut up about geopolitics, shut up about money and economics and ownership and structures within clubs, and just talk about football. And particularly last night, there's loads to talk about what happened on the pitch, but there's a lot of off the field stuff that's been going on for years across all levels of football, particularly elite level of football, about who do we have running the big clubs, and what kind of scrutiny do they face, and what are the reasons for running the clubs. And I think, you know, the announcement a couple of weeks ago by the intention of those 12 clubs to break away and form a Super League, I think that's really mobilised a lot of people. And to some people, that's just, you know, they'll take to social media. On others, like United fans, on Sunday, they'll take to the streets. But I think it's really woken people up, to think that it's no longer kind of good enough anymore just to welcome people into the game simply because they have money. We need to kind of look a little bit beyond that. So, the ownership of those two clubs last night, I mean, a fixture like last night and winning a fixture like last night, you would assume that's the sporting ambition of both of those ownerships, is to get to the latter stages of the Champions League, the knockout stages, to winning games and to get to the final. Man City, of course, were the ones who did it last night. It's a hugely successful night for them. But what surprised me and almost disappointed me sitting in the RTE studios watching it was almost how comfortable they were. Like, we on which isn't to say they didn't work really hard, which isn't to say they didn't deserve it, or which isn't to say that they didn't reach a really high level of performance. Some players were, like, they were outstanding. Fernandinho was brilliant. Diaz at the back was immense. Foden, yet again, showed. You're sitting there going, how good is this fella going to become? But PSG, for all their talent and all the money that was put into that squad and the profile of the club and the ambition, and you think, you know, year on year, the amount of experience they have in Europe, that they're going to go out and kind of deliver the kind of performance that comes from that experience. But they didn't at all. In the first half, they couldn't really compete at a football level with Man City, and in the second half, just psychologically, they just imploded. Like, we were sitting there at halftime thinking, okay, if they don't score in the first 5 or 10 minutes, then it looks like the game is beyond them. it's just a question. You can start your stopwatch. When are they going to get somebody sent off? And the surprise at the end was that they only had one person sent off. Di Maria went off, but I think Verratti, Kimpembe, Danilo, they were all fortunate as well that they didn't see a red card as well. So you can get a lot with money, but there's certain things you can't get. And I think within that PSG dressing room, just the structure of the club is all wrong. It's not designed to succeed at this level. You need a team. You need a plan. They go into every game with the hope that the best individuals they have will deliver, which is fine when they deliver. But last night, one of them was unavailable. Mbappe was injured. And Neymar wasn't at his best. And there was nothing else. They just had nothing else to offer. And Man City, in the end, got into the final in relatively comfortable circumstances.
What about Pochettino, though? Because he was brought in to do a job. We look what we did at Spurs, and it seemed to epitomise what is needed to make a group of individuals believe in him and play for him. And then he goes over to PSG, where he has better players, more money, and he can't get them to do that for him.
He's not there long. Like, he's only there 4 months or so, and he's spoken in the build-up to last night's game. I picked up the phrase in a few times, that he's trying to introduce a certain philosophy in the club. Now, you can read into that in lots and lots of different ways, but from a distance, when you're looking in a Paris Saint-Germain dressing room, you're looking at things like discipline and work ethic and professionalism, and you're looking to kind of get a group of players to, within themselves, like, not that they're relying on a manager to do this, but that they would kind of police themselves and set standards for themselves, that the players of experience would, on the pitch last night, just make the kind of scenes we saw last night in the second half just not possible. Now, they weren't horrendous. Like, I'm making out here, like, the scenes we saw were terrible. But, like, from elite footballers who were within, you know, 45 minutes of a final if they got their act together last night, and to be so lacking in any kind of self-control or lacking in any kind of ability to focus themselves, to organise themselves, to keep a cool head. Like, when the sun's shining, you're winning 2-0 and it's in front of a big crowd and the cameras are on, it's really easy to show how good you are. But last night, there's an opportunity to show a different side to you, like a different element to you, show you've kind of different kind of a calibre altogether. And then they were just found wanting all over the place. They don't lack experience at this level. They all have several trophies, and they all have huge amounts of ability, and I'm sure their wages are massive. So we're not talking about inexperienced, poor players, but psychologically last night, it was just so poor to watch from them.
Richie, because it was such a contrast, really, when you look at Man City. Of course, there's money there as well, but performances like Ruben Dias, he looked like he would have dived on a grenade last night.
Oh, he was immense. Like, you know, I don't know, over the years, when you look at Juventus giving defensive performances in some Champions League games, or Atletico Madrid, and you think of the way in which some of those defended. Like, he's in that mould. Like, he was immense last night, and he's been like that all season. And I think There was a kind of a solidity with City last night defensively. I mean, their defensive record in the competition is brilliant. I think they only conceded 4 all year in the competition. But last night, they just looked at, there was a couple of incidents where, as you mentioned, like, he just threw himself at the ball in front of the goal, which you might turn around and say, okay, that's the basics of defending, that's the least we'd expect. But he did it, and he does all the more difficult aspects of it as well. And like, there's such a contrast between the makeups of those two teams. Like, in the one hand, Pochettino is only in a wet week, and he's got a lot of issues to deal with. And I think there's an imbalance in the team, and there's a lack of discipline and a lack of structure in the dressing room. A lot has to be corrected there. But you look at the Man City dressing room. Like, even before Guardiola arrived at the club, they were building themselves to compete in matches like last night and to win matches like last night. Appointments were made to set the club up. The scouting operation, the signings that were made, the way in which Guardiola plays, the way in which all the players are absolutely in sync with one another. Like, they're the exact opposite. With Guardiola and last night, it's about the sum of the parts. They all knew their job. They can all rotate a little bit on the pitch. He can make 5 or 6 changes from game to game, and it doesn't matter. they keep winning. They're winning the Premier League, they're winning a cup, they're now in the Champions League final. So it's the exact opposite. PSG went out in the hope that the best lads produce something that you can't coach. And in the end, that approach was found wanting.
Well, let's remind ourselves of Mara's goals.
Chase led by Zinchenko. Foden arriving in the middle. And the cutback finds De Bruyne. Foden now for Manchester City. De Bruyne back for Foden at the pace. Oh, here's a chance for Mahrez again.
Mahrez is getting a huge amount of praise, and rightly so, Richie.
Yeah, he was excellent. I mean, to get the two goals in the way that he did. But actually, interesting, in the studio, we were having a discussion about who'd be man of the match. He didn't make shortlist in the top two or three names. That was an indication of how good so many players last night played. But before the game, there was a discussion. We showed a bit of analysis about, you know, how can a team get to this level without playing a central striker? How can you play without a recognised striker? And how you do it is you have players of the intelligence of Mahrez or Foden or De Bruyne, who, irrespective of where they start in any move, they always know that they need to be in a position there to finish off a move like the two that Mahrez did last night. So it was a masterclass in coaching and performance and dealing with an occasion and just showing how good you can be. And the City players kept their heads in the face of a lot of provocation and acting the maggot in the second half from their opponents. So there's every box was ticked last night for Man City. So they're looking really, really good.
What about tonight then, Richie? It's finally poised, Chelsea and Real Madrid. It is quite, I think it's going to be one of those compelling ones. But if you were to look at the two teams, which manager do you think is going to come up with the masterclass to try and get the win?
It is finally poised. I think the pre-match thing that your way, if you're Zinedine Zidane, Sergio Ramos, I believe, has travelled and is available. So it's a huge addition to have him in the dressing room. We'll assume, if he's fully match fit, that they will start him, given his importance to that team. I think this advantage of playing away from home was probably, if not completely nullified, it's certainly lessened by the fact that Stamford Bridge isn't going to be full of Chelsea fans. That's been the case throughout the lockdown. So, but the first leg, I remember watching it, like the big thing we focused on beforehand is the quality that Real Madrid have in midfield. That trio are outstanding. Casemiro, Cruz, Modric, and then Kante put out a world-class performance against them in the first half. So it is one of those fixtures that I think it's impossible to predict with any certainty. I think we could be talking about moments of brilliance, the odd mistake. So finally poised.
Does Zidane get enough credit though, Richie? When you look at it, three Champions Leagues, two La Ligas, you know, sometimes I feel, you know, everyone looks at him as a past player and he never really gets the credit he probably deserves.
It's a difficult question to answer because the question has been asked so much that I think, well, if we keep wondering whether or not he gets the credit he deserves, surely by constantly asking ourselves that question, maybe the answer is that actually he does. Because, like, I'm going to give the same answer that probably most people give when you're asked that, is like, it's an outstanding managerial record. He's not been doing the job for so long, but the trophies he's amassed, like, top managers could manage for 30 years and not achieve what he has. I think the reason a lot of people don't put him in the category of the top managers or the elite managers is because there's this feeling that, you know, he just kind of has a managerial approach which relies on just the players going out and kind of doing their thing, and that he's kind of hands off, or that he's not absolutely as obsessed or focused on tactics as a Guardiola, for example. But an outstanding manager, obviously, but curiously, he is one manager, even when he's not in a job, which he wasn't at Real Madrid for a while. He wasn't constantly linked with the top jobs that became available, but he will be if he keeps going the way he is.
But Richie, does he have somebody that will score goals for him? Because if you look at their last few matches, three of the last six, they failed to score a goal.
Well, Benzema is the obvious focus. I mean, he's having quite apart from the last few games, he's been having a superb season scoring wise. He has answered the question that Madrid have been asked of themselves internally for a while, like who will fill the goal scoring role that Ronaldo had. Partly because nobody else is stepping up in the way that he has. So, again, like the first, if you go back to the first leg, they didn't create many chances at all. And the kind of half chance that he had, you saw what he did in the box and got a goal from an opportunity that so few players would have even seen, let alone been able to take advantage of. So, I think that they're if they're Ramos back in defence, they have an outstanding midfield and they have a hell of a goal scorer up front. And there's a whole load of experience. There's the amount of Champions League winners' medals in that dressing room is, like, ridiculous. So, again, if you're pushing for a prediction, I've no idea what will happen tonight. But
well,
I can't
that's
wait
great.
To
Thanks
see
for
the
coming on, Richie.
You know, I think sometimes people think, oh, punditry, you've got to make a really specific call and predict things with real certainty. But there's a time sometimes to sit back and go, do you know what? There's a hell of a lot of strengths in both teams. They're at the level now of the competition where they've so much strength. A huge amount of money has been pumped into both clubs. They have a load of experience, and I mean, it's one all. There's no difference in the scoreline. Away goals may factor afterwards. There's going to be no crowd there, so hopefully it'll be a game that we'll be sitting there hugely entertained by.
Richie, which team would Man City or other face in the final, would you think? Which, you know, would they feel they could, you know, impose their game plan on?
Oh, which team? I suppose they were recently beaten, I think, by Chelsea in the Cup semi-final, weren't they? And I think they have a league game coming up at Chelsea, Man City have. So, I don't know is the question. I think Guardiola would go into either match, to be honest. Like, and there was an interesting thing, actually, last night. In previous Champions Leagues, I've always got the feeling, and so many did, that Guardiola would come up with a tactical plan that was unnecessary, or that he would tweak things to an extent that didn't seem to be called for, or that he was so obsessed with winning this thing that he would kind of overcomplicate things. But there was a pre-match interview that we showed briefly on RT last night. He was smiling. He was relaxed. He was asked, you know, how will you go and win this? And he said, just told the players to go out and win the game. Forget the scoreline, forget what's at stake. And he was so relaxed and he was so calm. And I think he'll go into the final with that attitude as well, because I think there's so much work gone in and they must believe so much in what they're doing. They've had evidence all season that they know exactly what they're at, and it doesn't matter what team he picks, you know, should have full belief that they'll go out and win. So I think this is a long-winded answer to your question, saying I don't think there's a world of difference between either. I think Guardiola will go out and send his team out fully in the belief that he can win.
Okay, Richie, we will come back to you maybe closer to the time and see if you got more of a definite opinion by then. Thanks so much for joining us, Richie. We'll talk to you soon.
Game on 2FM with Green Fern. Fuel your day with Green Fern's new high-protein cooked chicken breast filling. 100% natural and packed with flavour.
Game on 2FM.
Now, Donica, tomorrow is a really big day. It is Lyon's team announcement, or squad announcement.
Yes.
How are you feeling about it?
Yeah, I'd be nervous if I was a few of the guys. Of course, you know, you just know the way that there's going to be a few people blindsided and just think, whoa, I made it. And there's other people just...
Is that how you felt?
Yeah, I did in 05. I was like, what am I doing on the TV there? Like, I just couldn't believe it. Whereas there's going to be some people disappointed as well. And I have a feeling, and just listen to a little bit more there, Razzy Erasmus has massive fear of the Welsh game plan. And Warren Gatland knows that really well. I wouldn't be surprised if it was a Welsh heavy squad, and that's if my fear as an Irish person, if they can get the performance, you never really mind. But I want an awful lot of our lads there. I don't know if the performance has been kind of good enough. They've certainly
been consistently good enough.
Yeah, exactly. So look, it'll be interesting. The one good thing, Marie, is I've had enough of picking Lyon squads. They've been everywhere. So
yeah,
let
true.
Warren pick his and leave us see where we're at.
How do you get told? Do you get like a letter? Do you get a phone call? Is it
you watch it on the TV? Yeah.
Oh,
That's it. Like, of course, I know Paul O'Connell knew when he was announced as captain, same with Brian O'Driscoll, because they're there for the unveiling, but you're there watching for
watching
me, Bill Beaumont, Gareth Davies, just watching these beauties call out your full name. And so, yeah, look, it's an exciting time and I'm nervous about it, though. I know this is typical COVID. We will get our squad tomorrow, but we don't even know the full fixtures yet. So
let's not even trouble ourselves with that small matter. Right, let's move on. And we will be discussing all that tomorrow, by the way, with Stephen Furze and Dunica as well. We'll see if his Lions squad was correct. Now, earlier today, Aoife Cook launched the 2021 KBC Virtual Dublin Marathon and Race Series with the distances of 4 miles, 10 kilometres, 10 miles and a half marathon. All available entries are now open on kbcdublinmarathon.ie hashtag runyourtown. Runners who have secured a place for the KBC Dublin Marathon race event on the 24th of October will receive confirmation by Friday the 25th of June on whether the race event can go ahead. Now, Aoife Cook joins us on the line. Aoife, I think I've given out all the details there, but just to be sure, did I get everything out?
Yeah, it sounded like you got it all out there.
Brilliant. Look, Aoife, hopefully it will go ahead anyway. A lot can happen between now and October. A lot is going to happen for you as well between now and October because you have secured your qualifying standards for the Olympic Games. You just did it at the Cheshire Elite Marathon only a short few days ago. How are you feeling?
Yeah, feeling great now. It's been a bit of a whirlwind since it happened 10 days ago. So it's finally kind of after sinking in now a bit more, I think. And yeah, it's really exciting. So just been kind of making my plans now for what to do and how to train between now and then. So it's a really exciting time.
I can imagine that's so key and so important. Obviously, it's going to be your program, but have you got people around you influencing you or helping you out there to make sure that you're ready to peak?
I do, yeah. So I have my coach. So we're in contact quite regularly. And there's a few people that I would normally kind of train with around here. But I think, I've been getting a lot of support in the last few days since everything happened. And kind of the plans are to hopefully head away to train in the warmer climate, because Japan will be quite warm, so I need to get used to that. So those are kind of all in the plans now at the moment.
And if it was going to the Olympics, always your dream, because you've been running marathons and distance running for quite a time now. So growing up, was it what you wanted to do, or were there other big events that you wanted to compete in?
Yeah, I mean, it's always been the Olympics. I think that's kind of the big one for athletics anyway, everyone kind of remembers the Olympics and how athletes kind of performed at the Olympics and athletes who went to the Olympics. So that was always the big one. But obviously, there's other championships as well, like Europeans and World Championships. And yeah, in the next few years, if I get the opportunity for those, it would be fantastic. But the big one always on the calendar is the Olympics. So that's always been the main dream.
And if it's just on that, and looking back at your training, you mentioned some camps you might consider. Will you look to go to Kenya again? Do you find altitude something that really helps you with performance?
Yeah, altitude does help a lot. That's the big one, and a lot of the, I suppose, kind of top runners, anyone who wants to do well, will go away to altitude, once or twice, maybe even more a year, if it's possible for them. So the plan would be to go to altitude. It won't be Kenya this time around, just because it's kind of the rainy season in the summer over there. But there's a few places over in the States. That would be at altitude, the likes of kind of Flagstaff and Utah. So kind of looking at those as options at the moment.
I read a lovely article on you written by Cathal Dennehy a few weeks ago, and he outlined some of the training you do to get into the shape that you're in and to be able to hit the times that you need to hit to qualify for these main events. And obviously Cathal writes about athletics all the time, but he was at pains to point out just how dedicated you are, Aoife.
Yeah. So it's been I suppose it does take a lot of commitment and I suppose you need to be quite motivated, especially in the last year when a lot of the training would have been solo, I guess, you know. So I'd have been going out twice a day most days to go for a run and, you know, a longer run at the weekend. So I was covering 100 to 110 miles a week in my training. It's been pretty full on and just trying to juggle that with work and stuff as well. So, it took a lot of work.
If you just on that, that's a lot of miles in the legs. How do you look after injury prevention or just making sure you're not picking up bangs and knocks that can just take away from your training?
I make sure to get a massage every couple of weeks, which I think helps to kind of keep any major tightness away and stuff and just keeps on top of everything. And I do a strength and conditioning sort of session once a week. And then I'm a Pilates teacher myself, so I would do a couple of sessions of that a week as well. So kind of a lot of stretching and mobility involved in those. So all of that kind of combined, I think, has helped to keep myself injury-free.
And I'd imagine fueling yourself as well, you'd probably need a lot and to put a lot of time into that considering the amount of miles that you're putting in.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I just make sure to have good proper meals, you know, for breakfast, lunch and dinner, so there'd be a bit of prep involved in that as well, you know, making sure that it's good stuff as well, not just you know, kind of fast food or microwave food or anything like that. So kind of a lot of prep, like stir fries and dishes like that, you know, just to kind of keep, make sure I'm staying staying fit and healthy.
Even not everyone is heading to the Olympics like yourself, but I think since COVID an awful lot more people are out and they're more active, certainly, and you know, long distance running, you know, and it's probably not for everyone, but everyone's given it a bit more of a chance or a bit more time at the moment. Do you think there'll be an increase hopefully in people getting behind it and getting to their local clubs?
I do think so, and I hope so. It has been great to see so many more people out, as you said, since COVID times and everything, and just getting out into the fresh air. And like so many people have kind of taken up running, you know, kind of maybe starting out with couch to 5K and building themselves up. I think, you know, because, you know, everyone's working from home at the moment and people have, you know, just a bit more time and, you know, I guess people just want to get out more. That running, you know, gives people that outlet. And I think people have kind of started looking after themselves a bit more for their mental health and everything as well. And kind of running ticks all those boxes. And I think, you know, with running, you kind of have to get over the first few weeks of of a feeling kind of crap and not feeling good with it. Kind of get over that and to the point where it starts feeling good. And I think a lot of people are giving it the benefit of the doubt at the moment. And, you know, people that I have spoken to are really starting to enjoy it now, which is great.
So there'll be plenty of them signing up for the KBC Virtual Dublin Marathon then, Aoife.
Yeah, by the sounds of it.
And Aoife, it must be a relief to have the qualification time, just given the fact that it's so difficult for elite athletes to get into the races that they need to try and get those times with COVID going on.
Yeah, it has been really, really difficult in the last year. Like, I suppose, you know, the Olympics was supposed to be last year. And, you know, I was hoping to qualify, to do a qualifying event, you know, last April, a whole year ago. And obviously that was cancelled just because of everything in COVID. And every race kind of since then has been cancelled for the most part. So there was a lot of kind of doubts in my mind at times, you know, that I had to kind of overcome. You know, I was kind of hoping that maybe there'd be races cropping up in the autumn of last year, and it just didn't kind of turn out that way at all. So it's been really difficult just to find a race to run. And when this one in Cheshire came around, you know, I just snatched it with both hands. And it was kind of, you know, it's obviously not a race that, you know, anyone would ever have really thought about running before, like 7.5 laps around the countryside. It was a much different experience to, you know, the big city marathons like Dublin. But
you know, it was great. The organizer of that race was fantastic. He really pulled out all the stops to just get it going and give us the opportunity to try and get the qualifying times.
Aoife, excuse me now if I'm being rude or nosy, but Olympic qualification, whatever about having that secure, does there come some funding with that that can leave you relaxed now and really plan towards it, that you're fully supported from that side?
Yeah, I should receive some funding now from Athletics Ireland now that I have gotten the qualifying time, so it'll help kind of at least towards you know, my trip abroad, whatever I plan with that, and should help me out up to the Olympics. So it does give me a little bit of breathing space.
That's good to hear. Aoife Cook, best of luck over the next few months and at the Olympic Games. Thanks so much for joining us. And if anybody wants information on the Dublin Marathon, go to kbcdublinmarathon.ie.
Farm. Have your dinner ready in a flash with Green Farm's new high protein cooked chicken breast fillets, available in selected stores nationwide.
Game on 2FM.
Now, the huge Champions League clash is coming up very, very shortly, and the team news is in with Hazard and Ramos starting for Real Madrid, and Mount and Werner both in for Chelsea.
Very good. Marie, we did mention that it's going to be a restless night for an awful lot of rugby players, but Rugby Players Ireland always looks to look after both past and present players here and abroad, and we're delighted to be joined by one of them now, Robin Copeland. Bonsoir.
Copy. Bonjour, ça va?
I'm very good. Yourself, how are you getting on, Copeland?
Yeah, not too bad. All good now. I wasn't sure if you were speaking language or if you said something dodgy there. I don't know what you were saying, but
please tell me your French has improved now that you're over that side of the world.
Well, yeah, look, I started at zero, so if it hasn't improved from zero, there'd be something seriously wrong. But I know, look, we're getting there. I had a two-hour French class today, so I'm getting there slowly.
So you're going to have to tell us who you're playing for, because it is really difficult to pronounce.
Yeah, it's called Soyo Angoulême.
Wow. How do you chant for that team, Kobe? Like, what do they sing in the stands?
No, look, I had trouble pronouncing it myself when I first got over here, but yeah, look, it's a nice place, a nice city. It's a good club, and yeah, look, I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah, you're the perfect person to talk about the Tattle Your Feelings campaign, because you've been around, Cuppy. You've spent time with Connacht, with us, with Munster. You've also lit it up with Cardiff, and now continuing your journey out in France. How have you enjoyed it?
Yeah, look, it's been fantastic. Everywhere I've been, really, you know, just meeting so many new different people and exploring different places and different cities and different cultures, and being in lockdown over here is probably not the best way to see the country and to explore the culture, but look, we're making the most of it, and hopefully things will be opening up soon, and we can get out and see a bit during the summer.
Robin, we always talk about cultures, but when you go down a division in France, it's very, very different. What you probably see on a weekly basis, you know, you might give us an example. I know I was chatting to a pro league one club, and I didn't eventually sign a contract because I wasn't drinking wine, and they were highly offended that I wouldn't drink with them.
Yeah, no, it's very different to back home, and it's just, you know, players are the way they are, people are the way they are, and there's no changing them for anything, you know. I was very much warned before I came over here to, when you come into the environment of the team, you know, don't try and change anything. It's not your job to improve anything, because not only will they not respect you for it, but they'll judge you for it. And, you know, that's kind of how it's been in a way, you know. There was some foreign coaches here, and they kind of tried to get me to do that, but the reaction from the players was a lot of the time pretty negative, which was kind of strange and difficult. But it, you know, you kind of just have to take a step back and just realize that, look, just do your own job, and if you're doing that, everyone is happy, and yeah, it makes for a much better team environment.
It must be a bit of crack, though. Like, I know there's the madness side of it, but we've seen images of them lifting up the referee, different moments like that where you're just thinking, what's going on here? From the environments you've been in, it is very different.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, coming from like, you know, the likes of Munster and Connacht, you know, it's people are so well drilled and so well knowledged on what you can and can't do. And over here, it's just, you know, as I said, let the player be himself, and you know, there's not that many repercussions for it, and you know, they're just like, oh, that's the way he is, and that's whereas, you know, back home it's very much you're there for the team, and it's a team first, and you can't let your teammates down, and there's just a bit more not selfishness, but individual behaviour over here, I would say.
Robin, we're good for probably protecting what we have at home, and we don't like teams, our players to travel. We want them all feeding into the system. But from being outside it now, you know, if you were speaking to other lads, would you encourage them to have that type of an experience of being outside, and having a cultural experience and a life experience?
Yeah, like, absolutely. Like, I've been lucky enough to travel around a bit, and I've played, you know, at a lot of different clubs, and the thing you have to remember is it's great to build a legacy in your home club and, you know, be recognised and do that, but, you know, rugby is essentially a career, and you can take that wherever, and you can experience different things, and the pride of playing for your province is one thing that kind of Irish clubs tend to lean on a bit when trying to convince guys to stay or young guys to sign on, and that's one part of it, but there's so much more to the game and so much more to life, you know, to get out and explore and see new things, and you can ply your trade anywhere because Ireland is a very small pool, you know, there's four teams in Ireland, and you look at England has 24 and France has 40 something, you know, there's just so many more options. If rugby is something you want to do as a job, as a career, that there are so many more options out there. You know, there's a lot of Irish guys gone over to America now. I was chatting to John Poland, the scrum half, he's over in America. I was chatting to him today, and he's just saying how unbelievably great the lifestyle is, and you know, that's what options are out there if you're willing to go and look and willing to uproot and go and explore other places. And absolutely, I'd encourage anybody who's, you know, considering what to do with the next phase is you know, explore all your options, because, you know, there's a lot more than you think there is.
Absolutely. Robin, thank you so much for joining us. Robin's on in partnership with Rugby Players Ireland. You can visit www.thebigrugbyrun, which takes place on May the 22nd.